Mud Podcast presents.
Good morning. This is Mindful Mud, your monthly show on mindfulness and the way to implement it in all kinds of ways into our lives. Welcome, welcome, you all. And so I am your host, Florina Nickley. I'm a Zen teacher and a mindfulness instructor. All right, so my guest today is Renshin Bunce. She's a Dharma heir of the late Myogen Steve Stuckey. She was priest ordained in the lineage of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi in 2003 by the late Senkai Blanche Hartman. After 7 years of residence at the San Francisco Zen Center, Renshin worked for 12 years as a hospice chaplain. Retired, she now lives in Eureka, California. She and her sitting groups, Beginner's Mind Zen in San Mateo, currently meeting over Zoom 3 times a week, and Beginner's Mind Zen in Eureka, currently meeting in person in Eureka, are affiliated with the Everyday Zen Foundation. Although remote geographically, she offers practice discussion and spiritual counseling over Zoom. Renshin has written 3 books, Entering the Monastery, An Account of Life at the San Francisco Zen Center, Love and Fear, Stories from a Hospice Chaplain, and Remembering Myogen Steve Stuckey, a collection of stories about the former abbot. Welcome, Renshin.
I'm going to say good morning, Florina. Good morning, K-Mud listeners.
So let's dive right in. I would love first to hear a little bit about your journey first, whatever you like to share. And then I'm curious about especially your work as a hospice chaplain. I do think we're not talking enough about death in this society. We're living in a weird society that is not talking about inevitable things like dying. Right. Enough, I feel, really. And so I would love to have this conversation here on air and perhaps have some inspiration. And I'm curious to learn from you.
Thank you, Florina. So I understand by having the privilege of working with dying people, of being trusted to be the person who goes in and represents the enormously important fact that death is a spiritual experience. By having that privilege for 12 years, I was given the opportunity to develop a skill. So this is partly why I wrote the book. You asked about my journey. Fabulous journey. What a when you kick over the guardrails, you can have an interesting life. And I wanted an interesting life.
Sounded like it. So what brought you to Zen? Go ahead.
Well, the first thing is that I got sober when I was 35. So it all starts there. The drinking years were interesting. I was living in New York. I was in the rock and roll and art worlds. I was a waitress at Max's Kansas City while I was living in the Chelsea Hotel. You know, I had kind of a different checklist for a life, but I had my checklist, and doing things like that were on it. But as I said, you know, you keep drinking until the wheels fall off and then you get help. And I did when I was 35. And I'd say that's when my life really began. When you're drinking, you can't learn anything. When you get sober, you have to start learning something. So after I got sober, classic again, I got divorced and I got my real estate license. And poor me. I mean, I was in my 40s. Who was going to hire me to do anything?
And you were down in San Francisco?
So I sold upper end real estate in San Francisco for 17 years. Really difficult. And you know why it was difficult is because I was trying to be someone I wasn't. So the suffering that created drove me to finally begin meditating, right? I had heard meditation's really helpful. I hadn't been able to do it. If I sat still and closed my eyes and watched my mind for 30 seconds, that was it. So getting instruction, learning a way of beginning to meditate. So through the years of, you know, I have a Mercedes, I have high heels, I have long red fingernails, and at the same time, I'm going on meditation retreats. So meditation won, and I eventually left all of that and moved to a monastery. Sort of extreme. I like the extreme side, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I have some stories for sure.
So I lived in the monastery, which is Tassajara, which is that was something. That was a Zen monastery. That was training. That was, okay, it really is time to learn how to meditate.
Can I read a short passage from your book about the practice? Because I really love how you write it.
Thank you, Marina.
It says, it was a hard way to live, but this century-old method of taming the mind works. When all of the choices I spent my energy on were removed, there was nothing left to do during long days of meditation but witness the stream of thoughts that had been running my life and, finally, find a way out of the traps I'd set for myself.
Wow, that's okay, that's good.
You wrote it.
You'll have to send me the page number.
It's page number 16 in
Thank you.
Love and Fear.
Thank you.
So why I love this so much, Renshin, is because you're not saying quieting the mind. You're saying taming.
Learning to live with. The first person who told me about Zen practice, I was 21, and I was living across the street from Zen Center, the old Zen Center on Bush Street. And my neighbor said, that is Zen Center. There's a guy there named Suzuki Roshi. You can go there and you can learn Zen. And I said, what's Zen? And he said, it's a way to end desire. So I said, no, thank you. I was 21. I was just getting going on desire, right?
Oh, yeah. Full on.
So I never met Suzuki Roshi. That was all I had to do was walk across the street. He was misinformed. Desires are endless. So now as I understand it, Zen is a way of living with desire and not being controlled by desire.
How beautiful.
So back to the great story, when I gave everything up and moved into the monastery, I thought that was it. I wonder how old I was, 60, let's say late 50s, something like that. I thought this will be great. I'll live in Zen Center. I'll become enlightened. I'll look fabulous in black robes. I'll be somebody. I also have come to see my primary need was for family. So I thought, okay, I'm moving into a family. But after seven years, that family made it clear that there was no future for me there. So not everybody who moves in is invited to stay. I don't think I knew that. So that was something, because now I'm somewhere in my 60s. I have no money, no money, right? And I need a job. I need to support myself. So a friend suggested chaplaincy. Ta-da! I said at the time, you know, I could be a barista at Starbucks. By this time, I was priest ordained. So my question really was, how am I going to carry my vow in the world? That's the foremost question. And the vow goes anywhere. But the most obvious choice was chaplaincy. So I trained, a lot of training, went through a lot of stuff for, I wonder, let's call it about 3 years, and finally got a job in hospice. Most of the chaplain jobs are in hospice. Florina, when people would ask me, you know, oh, being a chaplain, how I want to be a chaplain. That sounds great. And I just began saying to them, you should be a social worker. Just go to social worker school. There's more jobs. There's plenty of respect. There's it's a much more clear path. And if your goal is to be helpful, social work is great. Chaplaincy was great. I want to say, it's important to say, I didn't go in as a Buddhist. I wasn't teaching Buddhism. I was not only meeting Buddhist patients. I went in as a human being. I paid attention, I learned my lessons, and I became the person who could say to a patient or a family member, do you understand that you're dying? Because even hospice doctors and nurses rarely say that. They don't say you're going to be fine. But it's so uncomfortable for everyone. So that's a very particular skill and a blessing. And I could do that because I believe through my Zen practice, I wasn't afraid. I wasn't afraid of death, and I wasn't afraid of talking about it.
Right. So there's such a stigma around just even the word, right?
I don't know if I'd say stigma.
Not stigma.
I'd just say fear.
Fear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We never believe it's going to happen to us.
Isn't that interesting?
I don't. Do you? Do you think
Exactly.
Florina, I'm really sorry that you're going to die, but honey, I'm apparently immortal. Isn't this the way we live? So when it comes for us, it's like, are you kidding?
Me
this
too?
Is serious.
Yeah. No, I hear you. Even though I feel like I went a couple of times very, very close to dying, it's not in the everyday mind, right? It's not.
No,
it's
no.
Like so away from that idea. Like we live forever.
So now I would say, see, now I'm retired 3.5 years. And when I retired, I lived and worked in Silicon Valley for 12 years. That was a trip. So I had no idea of retiring there. No, partly because it's so expensive. And also because competition is in the air you breathe. And the longer I practice Zen, the less interested I am in competition and winning. So when I looked around for a place to retire, I ended up here in Eureka. Now my practice rubber is hitting the road. Now I understand living with an awareness of death is such a trigger to propel us into living with an awareness that we're alive, that this is life. Oh, this is me living this life, which is also very remote for most of us. Right?
So you would say that actually really being with that fear of dying or that reality of dying is actually giving us more life.
At best.
Right.
Because there's actually, how can we get ready? Because we can't know, right? I could find a lump and have cancer. I could start losing my memory and have dementia, which is my worst. It's, I'd say, a big fear for anyone who's worked in hospice and seen a lot of dementia. Or an asteroid could hit the planet, right? We don't know. So what is there to get ready for? What does getting ready mean? And I think that it must mean living life fully while I can. I've developed macular degeneration, and I now have a substantial loss of vision in one eye, and I live with the possibility, probability, that the other eye will convert too. Oh, So I think, well, I should get ready, but what is there? What way is there to get ready except to enjoy the vision that I have while I have it? So this is great for living in Humboldt because there's a lot of really good stuff to look at up here, right?
Beautiful, yeah. And even just that whole idea of us, you know, stomping around. My old Zen master, Rilegus, has said so many times, what are we doing with these few 80, 90 yeah. years we have on this planet? Yeah. You know, when we look at redwoods, what's the choke here? Like, and we worry about, right? And we worry about our little universe and really think this is it. And this is so important.
Yeah.
And we get lost in that little, in that tiny little world of ours. Our ego, right? Of our little worlds. And
I recently heard that Suzuki Roshi, right, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, my lineage, recently heard that he said, you're so wrapped up in your problem that you forget to notice that you're alive. This is true. This is the truth. So, you know, look up and train the mind. Right? What is Zazen? What is seated meditation? But learning the mind. And I train the mind is probably too strong. Develop the habit of being able to look at the mind and catch it when it's up to its tricks.
And watch the tricks instead of identifying with it.
and love it all. Mm. Love it all. Right? That's the next step. That might be enlightenment right there. Drop the judgment and love it as it is. So that is a little woo-woo. I want to tell you, Florina, toward the end of my work as a chaplain, I met a patient and she was one of those ladies. She had perfect hair already, you see, perfect hair. Look at us. I mean, we're perfectly imperfect. She had perfect hair.
Nobody can see us. That's why.
I can see you. You can see me. She had on a quilted satin bathrobe buttoned up to the neck. And she was sitting on a couch that was covered with plastic. Got it? There she is. After we talked for a little bit and trust was developed. She told me she had done life by the rules. She had done what she was told. She married, she had a job, there were some difficulties with the husband. She put up with it. This whole life, the husband died, she continued. Now she was dying, right? When hospice starts, it becomes pretty hard to deny that you're subject. Now the end of her life was here. And she realized she missed the whole thing. She was really pissed off. Yep, because she had done it right, but it was all, I don't know what word. She missed it all. Great teacher. That was a great teaching. Yeah. So sometimes living this way, I like to say I never met a cliff I didn't jump off of. Sometimes living this way can seem as if it's creating more difficulties for those of us who are driven to live on this side of life. But talking to people like that really reinforces, okay, let's just keep on with rock and roll and find out what happens next. Because what capitalism and the patriarchy have been selling to us does not work.
Yeah, how sad when we wake up, you know, in our deathbed, so to say.
Let's not do that.
Yeah, exactly. And realize, wait, did I live my life or did I not live it? And I, you know, as you said with the eyesight, how to prepare for that, but how to prepare for death. It's really today. It's not later that we prepare, right? It's right now, today.
Lorena, there is no future. So.
Thank you, Renjen.
Let's not forget that. A few years ago, I was diagnosed with lymphoma. And that was That was a great experience. I'll tell you, one of my initial reactions was, oh, now I know your name. Oh, it's going to be lymphoma. Okay. I've really wanted to know. I didn't have a terminal diagnosis. I went through radiation. I went through Kaiser Oncology, which was quite a trip. Maybe the best thing is my doctor called and told me the test results were back and it was lymphoma, just as it was time to go down the hill and sit with my students. I had a Wednesday night sitting group. So after hearing I had lymphoma, I was forced to sit still in silence for 30 minutes. Fabulous. Because at the end of that 30 minutes, what arose, and you know, let's remember to say, this is not a matter of figuring things out. This is a matter of getting quiet enough that the truth can appear, right? And what appeared was, no matter what happens, it will be all right. You're going to live or you're going to die. If you keep practicing, it will be all right. You don't have to love it. You don't have to agree with it. You do have to accept it. So this was what I tried to say to my hospice patients. If you can find a way to accept what is happening, I would say it's going to be easier. I wasn't trying to teach them Buddhism or meditation, but here's how it's going to be easier if you're not fighting it every inch of the way.
It comes down to that, right? Over and over again. Are we fighting life as it is? Because we're not going to win that. We think we are, but we're not.
Great teacher Joan Halifax says, stop arguing with life.
Exactly.
But how do we learn to see life? How do we learn to turn our vision away from ourselves? How do we learn to stop being so damn self-centered, right? Which is the most limiting reaction there
is.
So
how do we?
Meditate.
And how do we meditate, Ranjan?
Oh, you know, Florina, anybody listening who thinks maybe I should learn how to meditate, there's a million resources. There's also many different ways. I started in Vipassana and it really worked for me. I sat with Jack Kornfield. The great Joseph Goldstein is the one who taught me how to meditate. Sylvia Boorstein was my therapist. So Vipassana was very, very good for me. I ended up in Zen because I met my teacher and he was Zen. He taught Zen. So it wasn't my choice. It was my karma, actually. So, and Vipassana meditation and Zen meditation, Tibetan, very different. And I think it's a matter of what something in us responds to. So I'd recommend to anyone who thinks a meditation practice might help them, shop around, see where you find a teacher, see what your heart responds to.
Shop around. All right.
we have, you know, we can do that. We've got
these days we can. Yeah,
these days we can.
It's true. Yeah. And sometimes folks never stop shopping around, though. That's
okay. Now stop shopping around.
Well, it's true, right? Yeah. I'd love to, I mean, really, this book that you wrote about your chaplaincy, right? Love and Fear, beautiful title.
You
wrote, it's there's so much beautiful thing in that book. So
Thank
many
you.
Beautiful stories, but also just your experience with how you grow into the chaplaincy, right?
Yeah.
And how there is not an easy answer to this experience of supporting the dying and being confronted with that. So I'd love to read another little thing, if you don't mind.
Sure, thank you.
So Renshin writes, I thought people expected a chaplain to be a Christian. And so I prayed and I talked about God a lot. I realized that instead of being who I was being who I thought someone else wanted me to be. When I finally relaxed and started listening, I could let my patients teach me how to be a chaplain.
Yeah, Florina. I worked with a chaplain who did one thing. He sang Amazing Grace. He stepped up to the bedside and he sang Amazing Grace, and that was the visit. So what a clever guy. He figured out an answer. And I'm telling you, the old ladies loved him. Oh, here he comes. Amazing. So that's one way to do it. That's a valid way to do it. I had opinions and judgments. Time for me to drop them. As a Zen student, finding the courage to keep my heart open. And actually, as the passage said, the necessity of being honest with myself, at the same time that I was being honest with the patients. This really opened the territory. Every person is different. Every death is different. One thing that I experienced that I never got over, I would be assigned, you know, these are your new patients. And I'd get a face sheet. Here's how old they are. Here's what their diagnosis is. And everything in hospice is driven by Medicare. So I had to contact them within 5 days. So I'd make that initial call. Sometimes I'd end up making a visit. And what I wanted to talk about was how on that initial visit, it would happen that I'd walk in the room and we'd be like, oh, there you are. I've been waiting for you. There you are. And I would have these deep, intense relationships. Other times I'd walk in the room and they'd be like wood, like what? Like, okay. And I had to, those visits were, I would leave knowing, well, I wouldn't call it exactly a missed opportunity, but I'd leave knowing that nothing had happened. And yet they knew they had a chaplain visit. They needed a chaplain visit. They had their kind of chaplain visit. Mostly it's the miracle of meeting someone and that feeling of, here's the person you've been looking for. That's the greatest. And you don't have to be in a chaplain visit for that to happen. If you're open, if you're willing to be vulnerable, which is kind of not what we're willing to do. Back to Zen practice. Learn to be vulnerable.
Especially, I mean, I could imagine, and I've done a little bit of that work myself, because I was thrown into it, supporting people in their dying process. And it's such a vulnerable state people are in, and I think they deserve our vulnerability.
The stakes are very high.
Exactly.
There's no do-overs.
Yeah,
I felt that, yeah.
And I think it deserves to be met with our own vulnerability, right? It's so important. So it's so interesting to me. You're coming as a Zen priest, you know, becoming the chaplain. Then, what's your way of thinking of where's the religion coming supporting work in that work?
Oh. Great question, Florina. So, of course, always in my initial visit, I'd ask them, and the way I'd say it, I think, is, do you come from any particular religious, spiritual background? I met a lot of ex-Catholics. I met a lot of people who were really angry with the Catholic Church. So that was something to talk about. That was something to make space for. Working in Silicon Valley, probably the majority of the people didn't have any religion. But I would meet, I remember an old lady was dying, a sweet old lady was dying, and her daughter said to me, Well, of course, this is not a problem because when she dies, she's going straight into the arms of the Blessed Virgin. And I said, well, cool. All right. My work here is done. So I met Christian true believers, and I will say I kind of envied that. A lot of problems and questions are settled when you are given this centuries-old tradition that tells you it has absolute answers. Here's what's going to happen. Wow. But Zen is not that way. This ancient centuries-old tradition just teaches you to say, I don't know. I don't know.
Just
Wait and
don't
find
know.
out. Go with the flow. I don't know. But yeah, it was all over the board. I think, yes, I had one atheist man. The story's in the book. He hated all religion so much that he wouldn't have me in the room, and he was completely alone. He was chillingly lonely, and he would not have me in the room. And as I was leaving, I saw he had a whole shelf of books on Zen. And I tried again. I tried to say, you might want to talk. We might have something. And he's lying on a dirty mattress on the floor. And he had called 911 because he was so alone and desperate. And that's how he ended up on hospice. And I'm sticking my friendly little head in the door and I'm saying, but. And he's screaming, get out. So he was an atheist. But most people are somewhere in the middle.
So
Most
you
people,
just,
Florina, haven't even, you know what, have not even thought about it.
again, right? We're not dying. That's an
No,
illusion.
not even that much,
Oh,
Florina.
I see. About what comes, like thought about
No.
what?
Well, capitalism is so good at keeping us distracted. People don't think about God, death. They don't have to. They're thinking about what kind of car, right? I had a friend who wrote for the Whole Earth Review. He did a one-page essay on the only real choice we're given is on the Elvis stamp, right? Everything else is just dictated to us, and there's so much choice that we're overwhelmed by it. When I was living at Tassajara, we were released into the world. Excuse me. I had 10 days a year in the world. So we were driving up to San Francisco and I wanted some yogurt and I went into a Safeway. There's this freaking wall of yogurt, brands, styles, sizes, flavors. And I'm like, I just wanted yogurt. So this is the way capitalism is keeping us overwhelmed by choice, so that when real life intrudes, we haven't even thought about it. This is really what I thought I was seeing.
Right. The distraction
That's
from
what it's
what's
about.
real, from what's perhaps I could say provocatively, what's important. Life and death, right? Yeah.
And distraction from what from what Trump is doing to us.
That as
That
well.
too.
Yep, right there. Yeah. And just in general, right? Just the distraction of, oh, am I actually happy with the life that I'm living, as you said earlier, right?
Don't even ask. Just keep doing it.
There you
Just
go. Just be in
try
the
harder.
routine.
Whatever's wrong, it's probably your fault.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, exactly. Isn't that just incredible? Yeah, it must be our fault if we're not happy. Yeah, even.
Especially as women, but there's another issue.
Woo, we're just like, yeah, now we're getting started. Now we need 10 more hours. All right. Yeah, for
You know
sure.
what, Florina, sorry, I'm so hoarse, on my refrigerator. I printed out a page. It's a beautiful picture of Thomas Merton.
Mm.
And Thomas Merton is saying, it's not my, my job is to love others without stopping to judge whether or not they are worthy of it. So this was another training that hospice was great for, because I was their spiritual care provider, whether I liked them or not.
And whether you were in their, you know, agreeing with their religious beliefs or any of their beliefs, right?
Set it aside. The great question is, how can I help? And the question behind that is, well, what is help? One of the things that I was taught in training that's still working in my life is I was taught, you might be the only person they can throw out of their room. They have to see the doctor. They have to see the nurse. They need to see the social worker. They have no power. They have no control. Many of my patients were living in really unpleasant assisted living facilities. If you don't have any money and you're old and sick, you're going to end up in, well, I don't know where you're going to end up, sweetheart, but a lot of people end up in a place where I wouldn't want to be. And they had no power over their own lives. They didn't even have power over their own diapers.
But they have power to throw you out.
That's right. It's the only power they had.
And they might have wanted to use it.
And if they did, instead of taking it personally, instead of arguing with them, I could give them that gift.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That might have been just good enough, right? Right there.
Most I could do.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, another thing that really kind of stirred me up when I read your book, Love and Fear, is one paragraph you're describing that you basically were just there and your job was to remind everybody that there's a spiritual component of dying. And I was just like, wait, what? That's not the obvious thing here? And then I realized, oh, in a hospital, it might not be. It's a business, right?
Oh, it's hospice is a business. Hospice
wow.
is one of the hardest parts of working in hospice is that the hospice companies really care about money.
It so, must be so hard, right? To wanting to be there and emphasizing that spiritual component of this incredible transition, this sacred journey of dying. And we even forget that there's a spiritual component. I was just like, I just had to breathe for a minute there when I read this. I'm like, oh, wow, where have we become?
It's a medical event. It's a financial event. I went to see, I think I had visited this family once, maybe twice. And I went, you know, by Medicare standards, you have to visit this often. You have to chart your visit. A lot of the emphasis was on the charting so the company would get reimbursed, so they get the highest possible reimbursement. So I went to see these people and they were, the husband and daughter were busy at the dining table with a lot of papers. And I said, you know, well, how are you and what's up? They were planning, Florina, they were planning the memorial for the next weekend. The patient was upstairs. She was still alive. But they were so, they had it charted out that she would die before the weekend. So they were getting the memorial. There's some busy work for you. There's some turning away from what's really happening. And
yeah.
She's upstairs dying all alone.
Yeah.
She's in the way.
How were you dealing with these moments where you just see that reality?
You really have to take a breath. And again, it's profound training in in dropping your judgment. I mean, I did not hang out with those people. I said, oh, okay, cool. I'm going to go upstairs and say hi to her, and then I'm leaving.
Right.
So, but really important to get over your shock, keep a neutral face, and get on out of there if it's that strong, if I disagree with what they're doing that strongly. Yeah.
Right. I want to remind the listeners, you are listening to Mindful Mud, and I'm here with Renshin Bunce, and we're talking about life, we're talking about death, we're talking about love, we're talking about fear. What else are we talking about,
Renshin? Capitalism.
Capitalism.
Smash the patriarchy. Fight fascism.
There you go. Now you have it all. If that doesn't give us a caller right there. A little provocation out there. Yes, yes. You know, another thing that I don't know much about, but you're writing quite a bit because I think you do have a lot of experience coming from that Zen background and being in a way in a different relationship, I would almost say, towards death, a little bit at least, as much as we can learn how to die by each breath.
Yeah.
But that of the End of Life Option Act, right? That we have
huge.
Now. And yeah. I would love to invite you to talk a little bit about that and perhaps inform folks what is it even for people who might have never heard of that option, and perhaps some of your experience, your thoughts about it.
Florina, it's big. When I started working as a chaplain, it was not available. And I would see people, you know, how can I say, complete pain control is not always possible. In some cancers, the only thing that could be done was sedation, a chemical, give that patient so many drugs that they were put into, it was called a chemical coma. So the End of Life Option Act was passed. We had a lot of training. It was very good. As it happened, I was the only chaplain at my company who was willing to participate. The others just felt that it went against their values. The way it worked at that time, let's see, if a patient had a terminal diagnosis, if a doctor said this person has 6 months or less to live, that's a terminal diagnosis, they could request getting the drugs to end their own life. It had been the law in Oregon for some time, and so our training consisted of how has it gone in Oregon. And one thing that really surprised me is I thought people would be using it for physical pain. No, people would use it for emotional pain. People would use it because they didn't want to be a burden to their family. Yeah, and it was up to them. Not all of the doctors at my hospice company were willing to participate. Some felt it was wrong. We had one, Gary Pasternak, great, great hospice doctor. I would talk about it with people with cancer who were afraid of the suffering that they thought they were looking at. And I would present it as you can use it to cut off. And I always made this cutting off gesture with my hands to cut off that really difficult last few weeks. You can take back control. It enables you to die with your family there with dignity. What else can I say about it? It was enormously complicated. Most of the provisions in the law are there to prevent it being used against people. Again, you know, grandma's in the way, so we're going to get the doctor in here and give her some drugs. That cannot be. The patient has to, and the in the moment, and I was present a number of times when the doctor says to the patient, I have these drugs. Do you know what they are for? And the patient had to be able to say, yes, they will end my life. And that's what I want. So that's a profound moment. But the patient had to be competent and the patient had to take them themselves. So, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, it's such a, as you said, some doctors didn't agree with it, right? A whole bunch of chaplains didn't agree with it. I think it's a very controversial subject, right? Is this really something we should do, right? Assist basically suicide. I think some people kind of see it as that, right? And I love how you say, you know, it's a way of dying in dignity. And another thing you're saying in your book and you're describing some scenarios too is like taking death out of isolation, I think is such an important part here to really think about. I mean, one of the most, you know, the saddest things I think is to really die alone.
Well, now, Florina, I'm going to say, people do want to die. Some people do want to be alone when they die. So there'd be cases where the family's gathered around, hovering, patting, whatever, and then they all go to get a sandwich and that's when the person dies.
Right.
So, but the sort of accidental, gosh, I would, in some of these facilities, I would see people who were in such difficulties. And yes, they were alone, people who had no family.
All right, I want to remind everybody out there listening to this conversation, take a deep breath. This is heavy stuff, right?
This is heavy stuff.
Exactly. Take a breath. Notice the aliveness in this breath, celebrating your aliveness.
I'm looking out of my window and those trees are so beautiful. Those trees are talking to me.
There you go. Yeah. What a blessing though to actually have this conversation. And you know, I mean, I would have so many other questions for you around this topic too, but I would love to give you a chance to talk a little bit about your books, about your offerings, about your groups, your sessions you're offering, just so people can get in touch with you.
Thank you. So I always wanted to be a writer. I always wrote. I've been on The Well. Some of the listeners are going to know what The Well was. It was social media before there was social media. I joined The Well in 93 and I ran a topic there, complicated to explain, but I wrote consistently to a group of friends about my experience of leaving my everyday life, moving to Tassajara, and then about what it was like to live at Tassajara. And later I gathered all of those postings and turned them into a book and self-published it. And that's the book, Entering the Monastery. And it's a very niche kind of book. When I was working as a chaplain, and I had so many requests of how do I become a chaplain? How do you do it? I thought, and there was one book by a hospice chaplain that was a bestseller. And I thought, aha. So for 7 years, I worked really hard on this book. And I worked on it to be a mass market book, to reach millions. When it came down to it, the pandemic was just starting. And when I submitted to agents, I couldn't get an agent. And so I went ahead and I self-published that. The pandemic was coming. I thought, we're all going to die. And I want to get this thing out into the world. And it's doing a good little job. It's chugging along.
Fear.
Good responses.
Yeah, Love and Fear is a wonderful book, y'all, if you're interested in this topic.
if you can stand. And then
I think we have a caller, if I may.
Let me finish.
Go ahead, the third book.
The third, I have consistent stories. My Zen teacher, Steve Stuckey, died in, I think it was 2013, and there are certain stories about him that I was consistently repeating to my students, and I thought, well, I'll put these in a book. The final thing I want to say, Florina, is I don't use Amazon for anything anymore. That wedding in Venice really took it over the, okay, no more, not a penny more. However, these books are published on Amazon, and there's nothing I can do about that. Readers can buy them through bookshop.org, so they can bypass Amazon that way. So, yeah, and I have a website. It's my name, Renshin Bunce, R-E-N-S-H-I-N-B-U-N-C-E. And it lists my books, and it also lists my meditation groups. If any local people are interested, Thursday nights at 5:30 in Myrtletown, come and sit with us. Okay, now let's listen to the caller.
That's a very wonderful offering. Thank you, Renshin. Yeah, let's caller, you're on the air.
Hello, good morning, Florina.
Good morning, yes.
Yes, I love what you're doing this morning, and I've been moved of the Holy Spirit to respond thusly. The word death is listed in the King James Version of the Holy Bible 376 times. I would like to quote to you one of those times, being Ecclesiastes 7:1.
Go for it.
A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Amen. Thank you for what you do. May God be with you.
Amen.
Thank you for that.
May it be so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
People would often ask me, what do you think happens when we die? Right? I had one answer. I don't know.
There we go.
But for those who, like our caller, had a sureness, had a belief, had a confidence, I can't argue with that. I can only envy it.
Thank you. Thank you, Renshin, for being here.
That's
know.
Cool,
isn't
right?
that crazy?
Amazed,
what
Marina.
The heck happened with our time together here? This is
thank
what happens.
Much.
Yeah, such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for being so vulnerable, so open, so and sharing your wisdom and your experience on
Let's
the planet.
Let's all go take a walk.
Right. Yes. Yes. Again, reminder, you have been listening to Mindful Mud. Thank you for listening. Be well out there. Enjoy your life today. Enjoy your aliveness. And it's a good thing to think about our death as well.
This has been a K-Mud podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.